Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name's Dave, and I'm an alcoholic. And I speak very, very little Icelandic, so I do apologise. I didn't really understand what was said. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very, very pleased and very grateful to be clean and sober today, and I really mean that. I'll always share that when I start to speak, because it is very important to me. My sobriety is very important. I'd like to thank Anna Maria for asking me to come and speak, and I probably feel the nerves going away. Whenever I'm sitting waiting to speak, you know, I always feel very nervous. You know, it's self-centeredness again. You know, I'm going to be judged and all that sort of thing. You know, but once I start to speak, you know, it's almost like for me, God takes over. And it just sort of disappears, you know. I just come and tell my story. I don't know an awful lot about AA in Iceland. My girlfriend's Icelandic, and she's told me some, which means that I understand you have a very strong AA here. The figures that I understand, I might be wrong. I'm sure somebody will correct me if I am. Is I believe your population is around 300,000 people, and you have about 5,000 members in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's a great achievement. I really do, because I mean, we had an AA survey in Great Britain throughout the British Isles last year, and the results of that survey were that, you know, our population, you have to remember, is 63 million people, but we have 24,000 people in AA, which shows to me that there's something gone drastically wrong with AA in our country, and anyone who's been to meetings in England will probably understand that. I have a lot of opinions as to why that is. You know, I really do have lots of opinions about that, but this is not the place to share that. But you know, if anyone wants to come and be bored to death for about an hour after the meeting, please come and talk to me about it. And I'll be happy to go on and on and on. My story, you know, it's experience, strength and hope. My sponsors always told me that this is what I'm supposed to do. I just share my experience, strength and hope. Whenever I try not to do that, try and get someone to identify me, I'm 12-stepping, I've changed my story a little bit or something like that, it doesn't seem to work. So I have learned, if you like, that you know, this is what I'm supposed to do. I was born in 1969, which makes me 34 for any mathematicians in the room, and I was adopted at 6 weeks old into a white family. My adoption was a good alibi system for a lot of years. You know, I had a lot of resentments around that, and I blamed it on an awful lot of the things that went wrong to me. I do not believe it made me an alcoholic. You know, I think it had no relevance in that at all. But it certainly did affect the way that I behaved as a child. You know, my earliest memories as a small child of not wanting to be me, of not liking myself. You know, I can remember at 5 or 6 years old sitting in the bath to try and scrub my skin to make it go white. You know, I grew up in a white area. I grew up in quite a rural country area of England. And there was no other people there of colour, you know, in the cities there are, but in that part of England at the time there wasn't. And I felt very different, I felt very isolated. I couldn't process that at the time. You know, as a child I had no insight into myself, no awareness of my behaviour, I just was. You know, this is stuff that I've learned in the fellowship through my inventory work, through work with my sponsor. And, you know, I can see now definite patterns as a child for me, in that I use things to change the way that I felt, to make me feel better. Before I drank or used drugs, and you know, it's very clear now, I can see it very clearly. You know, I was quite gifted at certain things. Academically I was very clever, and I was good at sport, you know, and I would use these things to make myself feel better. You know, I always used to boast that I've never failed an academic exam, and as far as that statement stands, it's still true today. There's quite a lot I've never turned up for. And you know, I was a talented athlete. I was a good sprinter. I was good at football. And I was good at these things. But if there was anybody from another district who might just be quicker than me, I wouldn't run. You know, rather than risk defeat, I'd not compete. You know, because I didn't like the way that I felt when I lost. Again, I didn't understand that as a child, but I could really see that pattern very clearly now. You know, my childhood, if you'd have asked me 5 years ago what it was like, I would have told you it was terrible. I would have told you, you know, I had a really bad childhood, and you wouldn't have wanted it. But again, my perception has somewhat changed at that. It's funny, in AA, you know, and the inventory work that I've done, stopping blaming other people and taking some responsibility for myself, I can see that actually my childhood was very good. And my parents generally did do the best that they could with what they had. You know, they both had very hard upbringings themselves, you know, and they didn't really understand maybe a lot of the stuff that I understand today. So, you know, they really did do their best for me. you know, and I can really see that now. You know, I have nothing but love for my parents, two people that I resented the most. Drying up, can I have a drink of water? At the age of 12, I found ways that changed the way that I felt that were a lot quicker, a lot more effective, and required an awful lot less effort than sport or passing exams. You know, I got drunk for the first time, and I can remember it very clearly. I think I drank alcohol before, family parties and things like that. I've maybe had a couple of drinks or whatever, nicked somebody, stolen somebody else's at a wedding, but you know, not really relevant. But at the age of 12, I was at a friend's party, I got drunk for the first time, and I remember it very clearly. You know, I went from being completely sober to passed out within an hour and a half. And passed out, was sick, I vomited. That the following morning, I felt absolutely terrible. You know, I felt really like the dry throat and all these things. My actual first thought when I woke up was, I can't wait to do that again. yeah, this is it, you know. And I'll be led to believe that normal drinkers don't do that. So I suppose the writing was odd on the wall for me. And what happened to me, I understand now, is that, you know, I believe that I drank alcoholically from the very start. I know some people have a progression. For me, there was no progression. I never understood social drinkers. I don't understand why anyone wants to go out, have two drinks and go home. Well, I know if anyone wants to do that, it's completely beyond me. The whole point of the exercise for me from day one was to get as completely drunk as I possibly could. And at the age of 12, I did that. You know, that was what I did the first time. And my life was just geared around that. You know, everything else was just not as interesting. You know, school wasn't as interesting, sport wasn't as interesting as it was. You know, my friends weren't as interesting as they were before. You know, and certainly this seemed to me like the answer to life. I quickly graduated into using solvents and other substances within about a year. And looking back at my life, I had my last drink when I was 29. And looking back to 17 years, you know, again, I wasn't aware of this at the time. But it was only really sort of maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 days in that 17-year period where I didn't use something. You know, there was always something going on, you know, whether it be prescribed or otherwise. I didn't drink for 17 years non-stop. There were periods in my drinking when I didn't drink at all. I'd be using other things. You know, and certainly, you know, I can really see that clearly. I mean, I never woke up every day thinking I'm going to get wrecked today. It's just what I did. It's just what I did. And, you know, I still managed to achieve somewhat at school. You know, I was very naturally gifted. And my drinking in that respect, and we used to drink at school. You know, our school was quite mad, really, when I look back. You know, and there was some of us we used to drink in class. You know, we'd take sort of still drink from our parents or get someone to buy it for us in off license. We'd put it all in a bottle in a big cocktail, in a Coke bottle or a lemonade bottle, and we'd just sit there and drink it in the back of the class. And we didn't think there was anything wrong with that, really. You know, it was just what we did. And but it didn't really impact significantly on my life. You know, it was just the best part of my life as far as I saw it. You know, and I still achieved academically, not as well as I should have done. But I was very lazy. You know, I learned very early on that I didn't really need to have to work to achieve. You know, that I could just pass exams just through doing the last minute work. You know, just leave everything to the last minute and just having 2 or 3 weeks of really working hard, then I could pass, you know, and that sort of taught me another really bad lesson in life, you know, is I never stuck to anything. I never really put my efforts into anything. I think AA is the only thing I've ever really stuck to, and there was always consequences to my drinking, even early on. I mean, the second time I got drunk, I blacked out, and there was always consequences. There was always episodes of violence. In my teenage years, I used to drink with my friends and we would go out and fight. That's what we would do, you know, we would get drunk and we would have fights with other people, with other boys. And that for me was totally acceptable. I had no problem with that whatsoever. But I've never had a fight when I've been sober, you know. Not once did I ever have a physical fight when I was sober. I got arrested a few times early on for drunken things, and all of these things I could rationalise. You know, I just didn't have any problem with it at all. You know, it was just what we did. You know, everybody that I was with, all my circle of friends, were pretty much the same as me. You know, they did the same things that I did. They drank what I did. They used the same drugs that I used. And so I didn't see it as anything abnormal in what I did. I left college at 19, decided that I was going to take a year off before I went to university. and because I really didn't know what to do. And I then decided that I was going to travel. I think, you know, I heard someone else say that they were going to travel. I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea, I'll do that. And see, again, I had no awareness of what grip this illness, this disease of alcoholism and addiction had over me, because I believed it was setting me free and that I was choosing to do it. You know, but looking back again, I can see very clear patterns. You know, from the following 5 years after I left college, you know, I didn't travel anywhere. You know, the furthest I travelled was the pub in the end of my road and my dealer's house on the next estate. You know, that was it. So I didn't go any further. And I'll be standing in the pub and I'll be telling everyone in the pub that, well, what I'm doing, I'm working, and I'm going to save my money up, and I'm going to go to Australia next year. That's what I'm going to do. And the following year, I'd be in the same pub, telling the same people, well, I'm going to save up my money and I'm going to go to Australia next year. The following year, I'd be in the same pub, telling the same people. And I was a bit baffled by that sometimes, you know. So I didn't realise, you know, that I was powerless over alcohol and drugs, and every time I ever got any money, that's where it went. You know, every single day, that's what I did. You know, but I genuinely didn't want to do that. I genuinely did want to travel and see new things and experience new aspects of life. Like I heard other people telling their stories to me in pubs, you know, that they've been to these fantastic places, and I wanted to go and see some of that. But see, I was a prisoner. This illusion that I had that alcohol and drugs set me free stopped me leading the mundane, boring life that everybody else had to lead. You know, I didn't want nothing to do with that. It was an illusion, because it kept me a prisoner. It chose where I went, it chose who I went with, and it chose exactly what I did when I got there. And I had no awareness of that at the time. At the age of 23... At the age of 23, I had a breakdown due to the time to my daily use of other substances. I developed a really bad psychosis, ended up in hospital, and was discharged into the care of my ex-partner, my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, I was very, very mad, you know, and you know, dangerously mad, you know, because I would sort of think about acting out on these thoughts that I had in my head. You know, I'd carry weapons with me, and I'd carry very conspicuous weapons, you know, things like 14-pound sledgehammers. Because my thinking was at the time, you know, that if people saw that I had such a conspicuous weapon, they wouldn't come anywhere near me, and it worked. People wouldn't come anywhere near me at all, and so that did work. But I did sort of, I suppose, manage to drink myself through that episode, in that the only time I actually felt safe, the only time I was able to go to sleep, was when I was completely drunk. And what effectively happened after that at the age of 23 is that I never really used drugs again. You know, up until then there'd been some kind of weird balancing act, you know, between the alcohol and drugs, and that, you know, if I was drinking too much and it was getting out of hand and I was getting into too much trouble, too much fighting, too many things, then I would stop drinking and I'd go back on the gear for a while, you know. And then, you know, if I was owing dealers too much money and things like that, I'd go back to the drink, and it was all sort of chopping and changing all the time. But see, after the age of 23, I decided that I couldn't use drugs. I frightened myself so much, you know, if you like, that with that being that insane, that I decided I couldn't use them again. And that's how I know that I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous rather than other fellowships. When I first came in, I went to all the fellowships because I was very confused where I needed to fit in. You see, given sufficient reason, I can stop using drugs. You know, given sufficient reason to stop, I do. Given sufficient reason to stop drinking, I don't. Carry on drinking. You know, so I know where I belong. I belong in AA. So after that, all I had was drink. And for the next 6 or 7 years, it was a progression, very quick progression. You know, I'd always drank to excess. But at times, in the early days, I could choose not to drink. You know, if I didn't want to get drunk, I just wouldn't drink anything at all. And that was fine. But see, I stopped being able to choose when that happened, and I just got drunk even when I didn't want to, all the time. Just didn't want to get drunk. But I worked in London at the time, and I lived outside of London. And for me, this is the best indicator for me of how this disease works. You know, they tell us it's a twofold disease. It's obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. You know, and that once I took any alcohol into my system whatsoever, it set up this phenomenon of craving, which makes it virtually impossible for me to stop drinking. And see, I used to work in London. I'd go to the train station after work at London Bridge, and I'd think, well, I've got 5 minutes till my train comes, I'll have a quick drink, I'll have a quick pint. So I'd go into this bar, I'd have a drink, I've missed that first train, and I think, well, I might as well have one more. I've got 20 minutes till the next one comes. I'd have the second one and think, well, I'm late anyway, so I might as well have another one. And then quite a thoughtful, I think, you know. and then, at the time, the toilets at London Bridge used to be on the station concourse. So I'd have to leave the bar to go to the toilet. you know, and then at any stage of this equation, I could have got trained, you know, but then I'd go back into the bar, you know, and so I'd no idea. So once I'd had that first drink, he might as well have nailed me to the bar for all the power I had to go home. You know, I wasn't going anywhere. I believed at times I was choosing to be there. You know, and then there's the subtle mental obsession preceding that first drink. You know, I've not once when I went into that bar after work was I thinking, right, I'm going to go in here, get completely drunk, stay here till it shuts, fall asleep on the train on the way home and wake up in Ramsgate after sleeping. Now, I've never been to Ramsgate in Perth. Well, I went there once on purpose the other week, actually. I mean, I've been there loads of times. They knew me at the station. You know, they knew who I was. They said, oh, I'm not him again. You know, and I'd have to sleep at the station, you know, and then go to work the next day sort of straight from there. You know, not once did I ever think I was going to do that. Sorry, not once did I ever think I was going to have a quick drink. You know, because this is the way this disease works. I have an understanding of it today. You know, whenever I picked up that first drink, I was expecting it to be different. Or just wasn't remembering what it did to me last time. You know, so... at the age of 23 to the age of 29, my life was just littered with them sort of incidents all the time. Going to the pub thinking, right, I'll have a quick drink and I'll go home. I'd have one, and then I'd have another, then I'd have another, then I'd have another, and I wouldn't get home. You know, if I got home, it'd be very late and very drunk. You know, the consequences of my drinking got progressively worse. I'd always been violent, you know, when I was drunk, you know, but that tended to be with groups of friends who were violent as well, and it was like, you know, the whole sort of male thing, groups of men and stuff like that, but then sort of later on in my drinking, I got progressively violent when I didn't even want to, you know, I didn't even know when I was going to be violent, you know, I'd be violent against the people that I love the most, you know, and they talk about the Jekyll and Hyde of alcoholism in the big book, and see, my demeanour when drunk did resemble me very little when I was sober. I'm quite a gentle man, you know, I'm not an aggressive man by nature, but you put alcohol into me and I'll be the most aggressive person that possibly could be, you know, and I became socially unacceptable to a certain degree, because people didn't want to be around me, you know, they didn't know what I was going to do, because I didn't know what I was going to do either, you know, that was the thing, you know, I just didn't know what I was going to do, so other people didn't really want to drink with me. I'd be standing in the bar drinking with you one day, and the next minute I'll be hitting you, you know, and I wouldn't even know why I was doing that, you know, And I suppose that, again, see, I'd always be able to rationalise these things. I'd always be able to rationalise all of these situations in my life. My personal relationships were always abysmal from the age of 12 when I started drinking, even before probably. You know, I've never effectively connected with other human beings. I was always there for what I could get out of them. You know, and I would steal and I would lie and I'd cheat. You know, there was numerous girlfriends and I could always find girls that were as sick as me, no problem at all. You know, that was absolutely, I was like a magnet, you know. Most of my girlfriends worked in pubs. Yeah, funny. You know, instant access to free alcohol. And, it was just a whole catalogue of disastrous relationships. During one of these relationships, I was with a girl and we ended up on the IVF programme because she couldn't have children. And it was like, it was another kind of sort of sick trade-off I can see now when I look back. Although, you know, I don't want to judge her because she genuinely is a really nice person. You know, and she really wanted me to get better, and she kept staying with me, thinking that I was going to get better and that I would change and all this sort of thing. And of course, it got worse. So it was on this IVF program, and it was like a trade-off. I'd go to this hospital every month to do these things and talk to these doctors. You know, if I could get drunk afterwards, you know, she wouldn't nag me about my drinking because I was doing this stuff. And the first attempt failed. And then I left her just before the second attempt that we were supposed to have. I used to have this job. Well, I worked with young offenders, who were, you know, young children who committed offences, and it was bizarre, really, because I was probably the most criminal person out of a lot of them. And, you know, I used to take them out with bounce courses and climb mountains and do canoeing and stuff like that. That was the plan. And we used to have these, like, psychologists and stuff, and it was to help them rehabilitate and to learn more about themselves and give them a sense of achievement. I used to take them away and get them drunk. You know, anyway, so halfway up a mountain in Snowdonia in Wales, I decided that I was going to leave my partner, because she was the problem. And she was the problem, you know, this was after drinking half a bottle of Blue Label vodka, you know, I was thinking, look, she's the problem and I need to leave her. So after I came back from Wales that time, I never went back to her. And I got a flat, and within 2 weeks I'd lost my job. You see, because sometimes these external things could enable me to control my drinking for short periods of time. So I didn't understand powerlessness, and when I came in, I thought, well, I look back at my drinking, and there were times when I could exhibit some sort of power over my drinking, some sort of control. You know, but what I understand today is that none of this power came from inside of me. You know, I had no internal power over alcohol. You know, in that, all the power, all the times when I could moderate or leave it alone for really short periods of time, came because of external circumstances, running out of money, the fear of losing my relationship, the fear of losing my job, could at times enable me to manage my drinking, you know, for short periods of time, but it would always get worse in the end. So outside of this relationship, very, very quickly, I was just drunk all the time. I lost my job, you know, quite rightly so as well. You know, they paid me quite a lot of money to do this job, and I wasn't doing it. And I ended up in this flat on my own, and I didn't really know what to do. I had my last month's paycheck, and I just went and bought loads of drink, really, and sat in this flat for 2 weeks and drank for in and out of blackout. And it was probably the worst part of my drinking. It wasn't the end of my drinking. It was probably the worst part of my drinking in quantity and in effect. I didn't eat. I used the place as a toilet, and it was terrible. You know, sometime during this two-week period, I rang my parents and asked them if I could come home. And they said no. You know, and I thank them for that today, because, you know, I'd always stolen from them. I'd always lied to them, and they just had enough. They didn't want me there house either. And that was right. That was absolutely right. So my ex-partner actually turned up on my doorstep and said, look, if you go through with the next cycle of IVF treatment, then you can come and stay on the floor in the lounge. You know. So here I am, like, you know, my flat's completely covered in my own urine and all sorts of things. And, well, yeah, okay, I said I'll go back. And that's what I did. And that's how I understand that there is a God today. I really do, you know, because I would never have chosen to go through that next cycle of IVF treatment if I hadn't have been in that completely despicable state through alcoholism. You know, I stayed with her, and a month later we went and did the thing at the hospital, and she ended up pregnant. Today I have a beautiful 6-year-old daughter because of that process. She kicked me out the day after. You know, I'd managed to kind of sort of clean my act up a bit because I'd run out of money, and you know, got another job and things like that, and I was off on the roller coaster again. And you know, for the next sort of 2 years, you know, I suppose what the effect of alcohol had on me wasn't working. If alcohol and drugs still worked for me, I wouldn't be here today. You know, that feeling that I got when I took them first few drinks, I talked about in the big book, that ease and contentment, that everything's okay with the world, nothing bothered me. You know, all of these people I didn't like, didn't bother me anymore. You know, nothing bothered me when I was drunk. See, that stopped happening to me. You know, I didn't get that anymore. All I got was increasingly mad. I got no ease and contentment from drinking. You know, I used to think, yeah, it's going to work this time. It's going to be okay this time. This time it's going to be good. It never really would be, ever. You know, the last 2 years of my drinking were absolute hell for me. You know, they really were. You know, I just continually had to move house, and I was homeless a number of times, and because I never paid any bills, never had any money. You know, I've developed a psychosis that I'd previously had on drugs from drinking. You know, the thing that had helped me before with this psychosis was making it worse. You know, I went to numerous doctors and psychiatrists and people like that, and nobody ever diagnosed me with alcoholism. They just give me more drugs. You know, and I don't blame them today, because I never told them the truth. You know, that's the bottom line. I never once told them the truth. You know, I remember seeing this counsellor, and he said to me, what you need to do, Dave, you need to write yourself some letters about how you feel when you feel like this, and post them, and then read them the following day, so that you could see how so I could see myself how delusional I was. I'd lie in the letters that I wrote. Stick them in a letterbox. You know, and yeah, it was just mad. It was really, really crazy. And you know, I believed at the end that I was being followed and filmed everywhere that I went. You know, every time I moved house, the first thing that I'd do when I got in my new house is I'd take apart all the light fittings and plug sockets looking for cameras. When I got a train to London, I'd change trains 3 times. So that the people that were following me didn't know where I was going. And when I got home at night, I'd walk around the block 3 times before going in my front door so that they didn't know where I lived, you know. And I'd do all that in a manner that was sort of apparently perfectly normal, so that they didn't know that I knew they were following me. I lived my life like that, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for nearly 2 years. I'll tell you, that was bloody hard work. Nothing else in recovery can be as hard as that. When I hear people in meetings saying that recovery is hard, no, it's not. It's a lot easier than drinking for me. it's as hard as that. No, if someone had promised me when I come to Ireland, that would go away and never come back, I'd just settle for that. You know, because that was an absolute living hell. You know, and what circumstances have brought me into AA, I don't know really. You know, the end of my drinking was not the worst of my drinking in quantity or effect. It just wasn't working anymore. I had this mad head and I had no respite from it. You know, some years previously, I'd had the seed of AA planted in my mind. You know, the big book talks about that once you have the seed of what the true nature of your condition is planted in your mind, if you're an alcoholic, you never really forget. At the age of 22, I can remember having a conversation with a man just talking about drinking. You know, and he said to me, he looked me in the eyes, he said, well, if you're an alcoholic, David, and you continue to drink, it'll get worse. And I never, ever forgot that. I never got that. And I knew that he'd been to AA. I knew this man had been to prison. He'd been a violent man and that he hadn't had a drink for a while. And he told me that he'd been to AA and that's how he'd stopped. Looking back, I don't know how well he was, because the reason why I was in his house was buying drugs from him. But, you know, you know, it doesn't matter. The seed was planted. And there'll be times in that 7 years after that, that were in the train station bar at London Bridge, where I was thinking, why am I here? Why am I here? What am I doing here? You know, and it'd be there in the back of my mind. Why don't you go to AA? What am I here? What am I doing here? And, you know, like in the book again, the guy pounding on the bar, what's this about? You know, I was completely baffled by it at times, and at other times I just didn't care. You know, and I suppose so I knew there was somewhere to go. I'd always refused to have a medical intervention, you know, because no one was ever going to get inside my head. That was the thing, you know, I never told any of these doctors the truth anyway. I was on medication for detox. I'd had my last drink two days before my first meeting. I'd rang the helpline, and they told me to go to this meeting. It was on a Wednesday night in Welling, in South-East London, North Kent, South-East London. And, well, yeah, okay, I'll go, you know. And so I went to this meeting, and I remember standing outside and sort of deciding whether to go in, really. I really wasn't too sure about whether I really wanted to go into AA. I'd had all the stereotype in England of AA. I don't know if it's the same here, is that it's a guy in raincoats with a bit of string around him and a bottle of a brown bag, you know, and all that sort of thing, and stuff. Well, I don't really want to hang out with them guys, you know. But this guy seen me skulking around outside. He's an AA member. He's an Irish fella. And he just walked up to me. And he looked really kind, you know what I mean? I looked at him, but he looked like a really kind man. He put his arm around me and said, "You'll be all right now, son, we're all fucking mad here. What's he on about?" And he sort of pulled me into this room. And it was a rough-looking room, nothing like this at all, you know. It was a proper rough AA room. They decorated it since then, it looks a bit better. But it looked really rough there, really dark and really gloomy. That's how I remember it. And they sat me down and gave me half a cup of tea. And the Irish fellow that pulled me into the room that night, he did the speaker, he spoke that night. And I'll tell you, I identified. You know, I remember that first meeting very, very clearly. I don't remember hardly any of the meetings that I've been to since then, really. But that first meeting, for some reason, is very clear to me still today. John, he spoke about this as being an illness. I never heard it described as that before. You know, I've been telling people for years I was alcoholic. I've been telling them for years, telling anyone who listened, I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, so I didn't really know what I was talking about. You know, I just knew I couldn't stop drinking. And he talked about this spiritual malady of alcoholism. He was irritable, restless, and discontented with life. You know, I thought, yeah, that's me. You know what I mean? And there are three words in the book that describe me to a T. When I have untreated alcoholism. You know, as a child, that's what I was. You know, my parents used to have to lock me in my bedroom, you know, so just to get some respite from me. You know, because I was irritable, restless, and discontented with life. I was like perpetual motion. You know, and when I was drunk, I wasn't like that. You know, I got ease and contentment. And I understand today, I treated my alcoholism with alcohol for 17 years and other substances. You know, I came to AA, John talked about that condition. He told everyone that his nickname was Honest John, and that he was a compulsive liar when he was drinking. And he just told lies endlessly, you know. He went into big detail about some of the lies that he told, and I was cringing. Yeah, I'd do that all the time. See, I'd lie when I didn't need to lie. You know, I'd never got to Australia, but see, after the 5 years that I spent going into my pub telling everyone that I was going to Australia, I'd end up moving to another part of the country. You know, doing the geographical that alcoholics like to do. And tell everyone in this new part of the country, I'll reinvent myself. I've been living in Australia for the last 2 years. You know, and I'd borrow everyone else's stories that I'd heard, that had been there, and make them my own. You know, and I'd do things like that continuously. You know, and then also I'd get found out and I'd have to move somewhere else. So when John talked about doing things like that, I thought, yeah, maybe that is what's wrong with me. Maybe I'll have this thing, you know. And then he talked about the twofold disease, the obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body. You know, and I understood that. You know, because when I drank, I didn't stop. It's as simple as that. I don't think, you know, apart from maybe in the very early days, that I ever successfully had one drink. You know, and if I had to stop drinking for whatever reason, you know, whilst I was out, I mean, dinner parties used to be a nightmare. You know, but for some reason, I was at a family function that involved sitting around a table. You know, the things that I'd avoid like the plague anyway, if I possibly could. You know, but if I had to be there, you know, and it's very open and there's only two bottles of wine on the table, it was like torture. Yeah, absolutely. Because I couldn't drink the way that I wanted to drink. You know, so when John talked about these things at this meeting, I understood, you know, and I thought, yeah, this is it. And I know today that I left that room with hope. You know, people shared their stories, they were very honest. And for the first time, I thought, well, yeah, there's other people that have done things like I've done. You know, I never realised that I was full of guilt. Never realised that. And it was some time into recovery that I could identify that. because I never thought things bothered me. You know, I really thought that I lived a guilt-free life. You know what I mean? I just didn't think the things that I did bothered me. You know, I just didn't think they did, because I could always drown it out. Every now and again, you know, I'd wake up one morning and feel sick, feel disgusted with myself for something that I'd done in my drinking. You know, for one particularly violent episode, against somebody that I loved at the time, I thought that I loved, should I say, and she told me what I'd done, and I felt physically sick. I felt physically sick with myself, you know, absolutely disgusted. I decided that I was never going to drink again. That's it, I'm finished. 3 days later, I'm standing in the pub halfway through my first drink, thinking, as long as I don't drink Cronenberg again, I'll be fine. You know, and see, this is the power of this disease. So sometimes the guilt would be there, but I never really thought it bothered me. And I heard people talking about their stories in this meeting, you know, and I've got hope, I suppose, because they talked about not having to do that today, not having to do these things anymore. You know, they said that if you don't drink on a daily basis, your life will get better. Try and go to 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, give it a try, Dave. All the pubs and off licences will still be open. You can always go back and have a drink if you're not happy. You know, well, yeah, okay, I'll give it a go. And I, like I said, I left with hope. Then an amazing thing happened. 3 weeks later, you know, the physical effects of my last drink and stuff like that had sort of gone away. And I'd completely recovered from alcoholism. It was an absolute miracle. You know, and I sat in meetings and I'd sit around and I'd look at everyone and judging them. And I'd think, they talk about this life beyond their wildest dreams. You trying to kid? You're lying. You're liars. You know, it can't be true, sitting in church halls on Friday nights, life beyond your wildest dreams. You know, you're having me on. You know, and say things, I thought you were just saying it all to each other to keep your spirits up. Because really, you're really unhappy. You know, you come to these meetings once a week as a sort of gee up, because it's really hard and we can't live without drink. Just to make yourself feel better. I don't even want to do that. You know, they said, do you want what we've got? I looked around the room, I think, no. I don't actually, you can keep it. And they said, get a sponsor. I thought, well, I'll be sponsored by Marlborough. And the blokes give me their phone numbers. I thought, well, I want to see Gay, and I threw them in the bin. You know, because look, my thinking was always, what do they want from me? You know, they've given me a phone, what do they want from me? You know, so, yeah, because I always wanted something from other people, you know. And so, I'll tell you, the only explanation I have today for the way that I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was so very, very sick with alcoholism. I didn't even know I was sick. You know, because I know I'm not stupid. You know, I know I'm not a stupid man. You know, I've ended up with letters after my name and things like that. You know, so I have sort of bits of paper that tell me that I'm supposed to be quite clever. So why couldn't I see what was on offer? You know, the reason why I couldn't see what was on offer is because I was so full of my own arrogance. I was so sick with this disease of alcoholism that I wouldn't take the solution that was on offer. I looked at that big book and without reading it, just well, I read one chapter, I read Freedom from Bondage, so I thought it might be about sex. But that was it. Yeah. And I absolutely decided that this book was written in 1939, so there's nothing in there that I could learn. Nothing at all I could learn from this book that was written in 1939. It's obviously rubbish, and I never read it. You know. And I stayed in AA for 7 months, going to less and less meetings and doing none of the suggested things. But I didn't drink. See? And I understand today that there must be a power in these rooms. You know, a power greater than me in these rooms. Because when after my very first meeting of AA, I never took another drink of alcohol. You know, and I've never been able to stop drinking before. So for me, there is a power here. You know, and what I ended up living with was untreated alcoholism. I understand that today. After 7 months of coming to AA on a decreasingly regular basis, I decided that the only time I thought of having a drink was when I came here, so it'd be a good idea not to come anymore. And I can remember sitting down and thinking this out, you know, it was like a real good plan decision. Right, yeah, I need to get things moving in my life now. I haven't had a drink for a while. And things are getting better, you know, because if you take alcohol away from someone like me, your life's going to get better. Wasn't getting arrested, wasn't being violent, paranoia and psychosis went away. You know, life got better, do you know what I mean, immediately. So I decided, well, I don't need to come here anymore. You know, when I come here, you talk about drinking, it makes me thirsty, you know, so I'm not coming. And so I stayed away for 11 months. And for 10 months of that 11-month period, I was clean from street drugs and from alcohol. And mad. Completely start raving mad. And I had virtually no debts when I came to AA. I didn't really owe that much money because no one would ever lend me any money, really. And but within 18 months of being dry, you know, I ended up £26,000 in debt. You know, I was working full time, you know, but I was just spending money all the time, you know, as a quick fix. I understand it now, didn't understand it then. You know, I'd opt out of life. I'd spend 3 or 4 days at a time not going out of my house, playing computer games rather than face the real world. not going to work, not living life on life's terms. Irritable, restless and discontented with life. So full of resentment and self-pity, it was killing me. Convinced I was suffering from depression and on prescribed medication. What I was probably suffering from, I understand today, was clinical self-pity. You know, look what the world's done to me. Look what it's done to me. Look what it's done to me. You know, poor me. And then, after 17 months of dryness, you know, I ended up picking up street drugs again for 2 nights. That was all. And it brought me to my knees. It really did. You know, and I ended up, again, see, this is it. You know, I could see things in my life that I couldn't see before. You know, I ended up, I was going to kill myself. You know, after 18 months nearly without a drink, I reached my rock bottom. You know, people in AA, I mean, in England anyway, they talk about this rock bottom as being, the hospital bed in the liver unit, the detox unit, the, losing the house, the wife, all sort of things. You know, for me, when I reached bottom, see, I had a car, I had a job, I had access to my daughter, the things in life that I thought I wanted, you know, and I felt worse. You know, the night I reached bottom, I believe, was the night that I got desperate enough to ask for help and mean it. I thought I'd give AA one more try before I drink again or I kill myself. It's as simple as that. And I went to this meeting, which was in Cornwall, which is 300 miles away from where I live in London. Mm-hmm. Why I was there, I have absolutely no idea. There's a series of events that took me there that were just bizarre beyond belief. You know, and I ended up at this meeting, and I was in quite a bad way, really. You know, and this guy seen me, see, I wasn't very well. And he took me away after the meeting. And he talked to me for about an hour, 2 hours maybe, something like that. Shared his experience, strength and hope. That's all he did, he just talked about himself. But see, I felt like he was talking about me. He was describing the landscape of my mind. I suppose for the first time in my life, I actually listened. I listened to what this man was saying. He was saying about all the things that he'd done, but I knew he was talking about me. And he looked me square in the eyes and he said, "Dave, you need never feel this bad ever again if you do one simple thing." I said, "What?" He said, "Get on your knees and pray and ask for help. What have you got to lose?" I said, "Well, what do I pray to?" He said, "Well, just believe you're not the greatest power in this universe. Can you do that?" I had to concede that I probably wasn't, you know. And that night, for the first time in my life, I said an honest prayer. You know, I'd said the serenity prayer at the end of meetings a few times, but never really meant it. I'd mumble it under my breath. Because I was having nothing to do with no God. I was much too clever for that. You know, God, you know, religion, the opiate of the masses, as Marx said, you know, and that's where I was, you know, that's where I wanted to be, firmly in that Marxist or anarchist camp, but I had nothing to do with anything to do with this. And so I tried it. You know, I got on my knees that night and I said, "Please God help me, I don't know what I'm doing." And then from that day to this, I've not had a compulsion to drink or use drugs. And what that man has said has come true for me. You know, I've never felt that bad again either. He told me, "This program's not broken, don't try and fix it. You should go back to AA, Dave, and do the suggested things. It's worked for millions of people, and it'll work for you too, if you really want to." You know, and so I did. You know, that man became my sponsor. You know, and by accident, really, I didn't choose him. You know, I never chose a sponsor, I never got up and asked anyone to sponsor me, not the great me. You know, and therefore, he became my sponsor. But I went to meetings every day for 6 months, and I got a service commitment and a fellowship. You know, and the first time I ever felt a part of this fellowship was the first time I made the tea at my home group meeting. You know, I never really felt a part of it till then. You know, I was the kind of character that would come in last, sit at the back, talk to nobody, and leave straight away. as soon as that prayer was said, I was out the door. And I'd probably spend half a meeting outside smoking anyway. You know, but I actually felt a part of the group. I made the tea that night, and it was all very nice. It was a lovely cup of tea, Dave. You know, I thought they don't mean it. They're just saying that. And, you know, also I've got service commitments, and my sponsor started to take me through the steps. My sponsor, he doesn't believe that the steps take very long. You know, he believes that it should be done very quickly. He took me through the first three steps on a formal basis and made me understand that I actually took them first three steps when I said that prayer that night. I didn't understand what I'd done then, but that's what I'd actually done. I admitted that I was powerless over this thing. I have no power over alcohol, you see, because I've got no effective mental defence against the first drink. And that's what he made me understand that. He took me through the book. He got me to look at situations in my past, like the train station, where I always expected it to be different. You know, my life was unmanageable. I had no problem with that. You know, I've been homeless 3 times. I had no problem being unmanageable. You know, that was absolutely a fact. And he said that the insanity preceding the first drink is the sanity sort of talked about in step two. You know, and then that what you have, if you have a higher power, is that you have a normal reaction to alcohol. You know, and he said that what you did then, you got on your knees and you asked for help. You know, in my own way. You know what I mean? It wasn't the step three prayer that was said in the book, written in the book. I did that with my sponsor anyway, on a formal basis. And Lena told me I had to write a fourth step. I didn't really want to do that. I mean, I don't think anybody really wants to do a fourth step. So, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't want to do that. And I balked on it somewhat. I didn't think I was at the time. You know, I'd always sort of find excuses not to sit down and write things. Because for me to sit down at a desk and do some writing, it's like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. And I'd go to extra meetings, you know, I'd wash the car. You know, I'd go visit my mum, do anything, but actually sit down and write this full step down. It took me 5 months. So I'll tell you, you know, I've sponsored a number of people through this now, and if it's taken you more than 2 weeks to write full steps because you're not doing it. Yeah, it's as simple as that. You know, for 4.5 months of that 5 month period, yeah, I wasn't doing it. You know, but when I actually, you know, again, I finished my full step based on resentment and jealousy. There were three close friends of mine that I made in the fellowship. We'd all done their fifth steps within a week of each other, and I was bloody jealous. You know? So I actually finished my full step based on resentment and jealousy, which is sometimes isn't a bad thing, I think. But you know, so I had this manuscript of a paperwork which is reasonably thick and contained my deepest, darkest secrets. So it really did. And I went to see my sponsor to do the fifth step, and is it in Cornwall? He lives in Cornwall, and he's got a caravan park there. You know, always choose a sponsor who lives somewhere that you like, that's what I think. Yeah. And so I like going there, and it's so he's in this caravan, and he walks in the caravan, and I'm very nervous, do you know what I mean? And right up until the last minute, I'm thinking, well, there's two things in here, and I just ain't going to tell him. I knew he wouldn't read it. I knew him well enough by then to know that he wouldn't read this full step, and that he'd want me to read it, and I thought, well, I just won't read them bits out. You know, right up until the last minute, I'm thinking this. Anyway, and so Tony walks into this caravan, and he looks at me, and he's tipping up a bit of the end there, the caravan. Dave, must be the weight of that fourth step down the bottom there, you know. So he's made a bit of a joke. And then he sat down, and he's looked me in the eyes, and he said, if you lie to me, you'll know, I won't, and you will feel terrible after this. Yeah. Yeah. And then he proceeded to share some experience with me about his fifth step with his sponsor and some of the things that he'd done that he doesn't share at meetings and that he doesn't share with other people, things that were very highly personal to him and that were on a par with or worse than things that I'd ever done, you know. And from hearing that, you see, I then had the courage to go through and tell him the truth, and we went through this thing, you know, and I told him everything. There were two things that I never told anyone in my life. And I'll tell you, I didn't know how much power they had over me until they were gone. Until I shared them with God and another human being. I didn't know. You know, I felt physically lighter after my first step, my fifth step. And the book talks about that we then begin to have an experience of God. You know, we feel the presence of God. And I really felt that. We went outside afterwards and we burnt it. And I know some people don't do that. But, you know, I found it very good for me, you know, because my sponsor told me some horror stories about other people that he sponsored and wives had found it and things like that. I want that, you know, and it felt very good. And he said that it's like a closing. You know, there's a closure day here on this, you know. And we watched it going up in smoke, and he put his arm around me. And, you know, I had tears in my eye. He said, there you go. That's how significant your life is in this big wide world. It's a puff of smoke, you know. And I felt it. For the first time in my life, I felt a touch of humility. You know, I've always been so full of arrogance and myself and self-will and self-centeredness and selfishness that for the first time I felt that was going away with this smoke that was burning. And we then proceeded a little while after that to do steps 6 and 7. You know, my sponsor helped me with identifying what my character defects were. Thank you. And he was very kind about that. He said, well, no, actually, what you are is. And because I didn't know the words or the language, you know, I'd identify them in the full step, but in my own words, if you like, my own language. And he helped me put the semantics to it and understand how they worked in me. And he said, are you entirely willing to have these defects of character removed? And there were two that I weren't, actually, because I didn't really understand why they were bad. And I thought lust was just lust, and that was it. You know, it's just what we have. We have lust, and that's natural. You know, I didn't think there was anything particularly wrong with that. But he made me look back at my sex relations and said, well, did you see how your lust has led you to behave in selfish ways and led you to be dishonest? And it had, you know, on numerous occasions. And then I'd understand that this was a defect and it shouldn't be there. And I had this thing that I termed in mine as an intellectual pride, you know, because I like to know more than other people. I like to think I do, and even if I don't, I pretend I will, you know. I'll sit and have a conversation about something I know nothing about. And it's always been, like, if you like, one of my major sort of things to make me feel better in life about than other people, because I can make you feel bad because I think I know more than you. You know, and he made me see how that affected my relationships with other people. He said, you realise that people really don't like you very much, Dave, because you make them feel small. You know, they just see you as arrogant. You know, so this intellectual pride that I'd identified, he identified as arrogance. You know, and he was absolutely right. You know, so I was entirely willing, and I got on my knees and I said the seven-step prayer. And I still have most of them character defects, but some of them have been removed completely. You know, and I believe God does for me what I can't do for myself. He really does. The ones that were most damaging for me have gone. They really have. My dishonesty is no longer there. I'm an honest man today. I really am. And steps 8 and 9, I knew who the people were I needed to make amends to, because I've written them all down and there's resentments in the holster. It's a funny correlation, because, you know, most of the people I resented are the ones I have to make amends to. You know, it's bizarre. And we went through them one by one, about, you know, looked at the harm that I'd done these people, and wherever possible to make direct amends, set them to do so and harm them or others. And my sponsor helped me with that. And I believe if I'd gone out and done my amends on my own, I'd have got it completely wrong. You know, I really believe that. You know, because I didn't really. He used his experience. He shared his experience with me, and helped me to identify what I needed to do. And he gave me a list of actions for each of these amends that I needed to do. And I went out and did them. You know, and I'll tell you, you know, it's a wonderful thing. You know, I didn't always get the responses that I thought I would. And most people, funnily enough, that I went to and make amends to, said, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about?" Because I wasn't as important in other people's lives as I thought I was. Well, I thought they were thinking about this for the rest of their lives, and it's really damaged them. They weren't, they're getting on with their life. And, you know, but I'll tell you, I had one experience making amends to an ex-girlfriend that sort of kind of blew me away somewhat. You know, I assaulted her one night whilst I was drunk and in blackout and didn't remember doing it. I was around the house having dinner one night, and this was the time to make amends, you know, and I knew it wasn't. So I said to her, you know, I need to admit that I was wrong. You know, cause it's easy to say sorry, it's difficult to admit you're wrong. You know, that's the thing. I said sorry lots of times before. You know, but to admit I'm wrong, I admit I was wrong. You know, what I did was really bad, and I'll forever be sorry about that. And she, I said, well, how have you ever been able to forgive me? You know, I was interested in how this person still wanted my company. You know, and she said, well, it wasn't you. She said, it looked like you, but you weren't there. But I'll tell you, if I ever wanted an indicator of what alcohol did to me, that was it. It turned me into someone else. And she said, it didn't even look like you. You know, that's a powerful statement for me. You know, and again, I felt very humbled, you know, by that experience. Steps 10, 11 and 12 were explained to me as my daily program. It's as simple as that. You know, I'm not a perfect human being. You know, I do get things wrong all the time. I've tried to promptly admit it. My behaviour these days, it tends to be fairly good. You know, I don't tend to act out on the faults that I have sometimes. You know, I get resentments, and I have these thoughts and things that, you know, I don't tend to act out on it. My behaviour seems to be fairly okay. So the direct amends that I need to make tend not to be that many, you know. But the thought processes can sometimes be very bad, you know, and that's what I need my inventory work for. And I can be very lazy with that, you know. I'll admit that sloth is a big character defect in me in areas of life that I don't really want to do, you know. And that's part of it. For prayer and meditation, my concept of my God has changed somewhat over the last 3.5 years. You know, I started to believe that I wasn't the greatest power in this universe. You know, that was as good as I could do at the time. And over a period of time, as I've had experience of this program working in my life, you know, I've come to believe it. You know, I have absolute faith today in a God that I understand. You know, I really do. It's my God, and it might be the same as someone else's here, I don't know. But, you know, it certainly works well enough for me. And the 12-step stuff, I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, sometimes I'm not very good at it. But every day I will do something, you know, and I really do try to keep my side of the street clean. And carrying the message to the suffering alcoholic. You know, I take that very seriously indeed. You know, if there's anywhere that I ever feel the presence of God, it's in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If there's anywhere that I really feel the presence of God, it's when I go and do the prison service at, I go to Belmarsh Prison in South East London, which is the most secure prison in Europe. And some of the guys that are there shouldn't be there. They're there because they got drunk. You know, and I'll tell you, I get very humbled by that. And I feel the presence of God. You know, I love the 12-step work. You know, I've done every possible form, probably, of alcohol and drugs that's possible to do. You know, I was like a do-it-yourself chemist at times, just trying to get the combination just right, you know. And it never really worked. A couple of times, maybe, sort of, you know, in the early rave scene days where I got where I wanted to be, you know. But since then, it was never really the same. And dangerous sports, you know, I did dangerous sports and also dangerous sports and drugs, you know. But the best buzz I've ever had in my life is working with other alcoholics. You know, I sponsored a number of other men through the steps, as I was sponsored through the steps, using the big book. And to see them come alive and their lives change is a wonderful experience, to have played a small part in that. You know, one of the guys that I sponsored, he 12-stepped his mother into AA just over a year ago now. She's now sponsoring people. She's now done the steps, had her own spiritual awakening, and she's sponsoring people through the steps. And to play a small part in that chain of what is real human beings is a wonderful experience. I just wouldn't want to miss. You know, I thought the chapter of Vision for You in the big book was just a huge exaggeration when I first read it. Well, life can't be like that, surely. But I've experienced of it today. You know, and what Wilson wrote in that book is absolutely true. You know, it really is. You know, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, people told me that when I came to AA, that I could have this life beyond my wildest dreams. You know, what are you on about? I experienced that. It isn't the dreams that I thought I had. Do you know what I mean? Isn't the blondes, the champagne, fast cars, and all that sort of thing. You know, it's peace of mind. You know, I feel comfortable with myself today. You know, I have a daughter who's 6 years old. She's with me in Iceland this week. She's having a wonderful time. You know, I had to go to court and get access to all these things in my early recovery. And I learned a good lesson there, that the best thing for me to do in them situations is just to keep my mouth shut. And that's what I did. I just didn't say a thing. And let everybody else say all the bad things that I've done, and I just kept my mouth shut. Today I have no restrictions at all. It's been like that for a few years. She stays with me the weekends. We go on holidays together. And she's a lovely little girl. She really is. She's very beautiful. And she's, you know, she's just gorgeous. She really is. And the fact that I can be a responsible parent is beyond my wildest dreams. I turn up when I'm supposed to. She comes to no harm when she's in my company. That's beyond my wildest dreams. I work a regular full-time job today. You know, I do my job properly when I'm there. You know, that's amazing. You know, my attitude to work, it used to be, well, I'll do absolutely the bare minimum I possibly can, see how long I can get away with it for, leave or get sacked. You know, it's as simple as that. You know, today I actually do my job properly. I'm quite respected in my field of work, and people come and ask me for my opinion and things and stuff like that. But I get good self-esteem from that, you know. I haven't had that psychosis and paranoia today. You know, I haven't had to worry for a long time now about the police coming and knocking on my door. You know, it's beyond my wildest dreams to have that easy life. Do you know what I mean? To do the right thing and just to have that easy life. And I suppose most important of all, you see, I don't feel irritable, discontented most of the time. You know, I feel fairly okay. You know, no longer am I that little boy anymore who just really didn't like himself. You know, no longer am I that horrible alcoholic addict who I just couldn't stand the sight of myself in the mirror at the end of my drinking and using. You know, today I spent far too long with me in the mirror. And it's great, you know what I mean? It really is. See, I feel like a human being. You know, this program's turned me into a human being. The evidence of my spiritual awakening, if you like, is that I've changed. It's as simple as that. You know, I've experienced the psychic change that is promised in this book. The condition of alcoholism has been relieved from me for today. You know, I'm a recovered alcoholic. You know, I drank and used every day pretty much for 17 years, and today I haven't wanted to do that. You know, my gratitude is immense for this fellowship, it really is. And I need to focus on gratitude in my everyday life. If I don't focus on the things that I'm grateful for, automatically, because it is my nature, I want things that I haven't got. You know, and you know, no longer am I comfortable and happy driving the car that I've got. I want the bloke's BMW who's driving in front of me, you know, and things like that. I need to focus. I need to be very grateful. I'm a very fortunate human being. Where I should be with this disease is either locked up or dead. You know, I have no doubt that if for the last 5 years I would be drinking, I probably would be dead or doing a very long prison sentence. And today I'm a free man. You know, I'm a free man who has choices in his life. You know, I go where I want to go today. You know, I go who I want to go with. I'll do what I want to do when I get there. And my life was never like that before. Thanks very much for listening.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.